Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to Clash of the Titles, the podcast that sees two movies with something in common go head-to-head to see which one does it better, and welcome to part two of this week's Clash. So on Monday, I recalled Total Recall in all its gory glory, and today we're tackling a movie that Chris describes as its kindred spirit in our most confusing Twitter clue yet. If only we had a way of seeing that clue before he wrote it and preventing it ever happening. Yes, from 2002, we're talking Minority Report.
Okay, Jad, what's coming?
Double homicide, one male, one female. Killers male, white, 40s.
Set up a perimeter and tell them we're en route.
I'm placing you under arrest for the future murder of Sarah Marks.
Give the man his hat.
The future can be seen.
All we have to run on are the images that they produce.
We see what they see.
There hasn't been a murder in 6 years. There's nothing wrong with the system. It is
perfect. I agree.
Murder can be stopped.
Tell me exactly what it is you're looking for.
Flaws.
Did we get any false positives?
We are arresting individuals who have broken no law.
But they will.
The fact that you prevent it from happening doesn't change the fact that it was going to happen.
The system can't be wrong.
Run! We'll have a winner at the end of the show. But which film will it be? Let's find out. It's Clash of the Titles.
Release the Kraken!
Hello, Clash Potters. You'd better drink this. Soon you won't be able to swallow, and then you'll be totally buggered. I'm Alex Zane.
I'm Vicky Crompton.
I'm Philip Kindred Dick.
Total Recall versus Minority Report. Victoria's choices remind us why.
Because we're doing a Spielberg special, and these are great films to compare, with one of them being directed by Steven Spielberg.
Convincing.
Is that right?
Yeah, that is exactly right. So very quickly, if you haven't subscribed to us, if you'd be so kind enough to do that, it would be amazing. And also, if you could leave us a rating, that would be cool. And a review would be even better. And if you do leave us a review, it might be read out by the one and only Chris Tilley, a.k.a. Chris Thrilly, which sounds a lot like this.
I managed to find a review that doesn't mention me by name this week. You'll be pleased to know. This is from Angela's man, who says, a fantastic show that my wife and I need to listen to every week as soon as the episodes come out. Laugh out loud, funny, endlessly interesting and utterly charming. P.S. If you are Danny Boyle, it's probably best to give this a miss. This will break your heart every time your films come on.
Oh,
have we not picked Danny Boyle movie? Danny Boyle has lost 3 out of 3.
Whoa.
And every time I voted for Danny Boyle. I'm in your corner, Danny. It's Vicky and Alex that don't like you.
Wow. What were the movies? Do you remember?
So... Shallow Grave, Simple Plan.
Simple Plan.
Oh, I'm fine with that. Yeah. I'm fine with that one.
Right, cool.
28 Days Later, I'm Legend. Wrong vote. That's the one I believe you got wrong.
Oh, and Sunshine.
And then Event Horizon, Sunshine. Definitely a nostalgia vote. 100% nostalgia vote.
I think, if I'm right, every single one of those on the Twitter poll, not to attach too much weight to the Twitter poll, was in our favour in the non-Danny Boyle corner.
28 Days Later.
I just... I like I Am Legend and 28 Days Later, the digital quality on that movie, I don't want to do it again. So on Monday, I took our ass to Mars, and today it's Chris's report on Minority Report. Chris, take us on a journey.
Everybody run, said the poster. Everybody run, said the trailer. Everybody run, says the police force who stop crimes before they happen. Minority Report starts with them preventing one such crime, and then the guilty party doesn't run, thereby undermining the film's entire marketing campaign. But Tom Cruise does. He runs when told he'll commit a murder, and he runs for the rest of the movie, running up to, then away from an array of colourful characters as he endeavours to clear his name. He fails and gets put away, which is where the movie should end. But this is Steven Spielberg circa 2002, so there's an extra 20 minutes that very nearly spoil proceedings. And then the film does end, the end. So, Vicky, this was a cinema watch for you, wasn't
it? Yeah, oh, thank you for remembering. We were super excited in my house. We all trooped down to the cinema and had a brilliant time. And I've never seen it again until this week, but I remember so many little moments from it. I maybe don't remember the plot so much, but the tech was in love with the tech, still in love with it. I still think it looks visionary and incredible. Some of the action sequences I'm not mad about, but yeah, it was a very enjoyable rewatch.
Alex? I've seen it. This would be the third watch for me. Always just for fun. Wanted to see it. Steven Spielberg, Tom Cruise, why not? And it's a weird one in so much as this is a film that every time I've seen it, it's grown on me more. I remember I really was like, I thought it was decidedly average when I first watched it. Then I watched it again and I enjoyed it more. And I enjoyed it more this time. And yet it is a movie that I swear you watch and you go, hey, that was good. And it epitomizes forgettable cinema. Like, nothing about this film stayed with me afterwards. And already, even now, once we're done with this pod, I'm not going to remember Minority Report.
One thing stayed with me. So I went to the press screening of this. I just started working in film journalism and I thought it was great, but I was also really annoyed that one of the big moments in the film was lifted from one of my very favorite movies.
Oh, give us a clue.
It's when someone gets murdered. We'll get to it because okay. I'm still annoyed.
Okay.
So, a bit of background on this one. It's based on a short story by Philip Kindred Dick. First published in Fantastic Universe in 1956. This guy could see into the future. Much like We Remember It For You Wholesale, it's 19 pages long. But unlike Alex, I did read this one. So, differences. The short story is set in New York rather than Washington. Anderton, the main character that Tom Cruise plays, he's bald and fat and in his 50s. In the story, which contrasts with Whitwer much better.
Yeah.
Rather than being quite similar in this film. He's the commissioner of police and the originator of pre-crime. And the precogs are proper mutants in this version. They're kind of idiots sat babbling. But they prophesize crimes, petty crimes as well as murder. And the same setup happens. John Anderton gets told he'll kill someone in a week, a person called Leopold Kaplan, who he's never heard of. He investigates, find out Kaplan's a retired army general, and there's loads of stuff happens similar to the film, different to the film.
Has he lost his kid?
No kid. There's no kid stuff. He's happily married in this version, actually. And he eventually realises that Kaplan has been behind it all along. He wants the army to have total authority and via military law, and so he wants to bring down pre-crime. And so Anderton realises the only way to prevent this and to prove pre-crime still works is to kill Kaplan. And so he does. He kills him in front of a load of people at a rally, shoots him dead, and the story ends with Anderton and his wife imprisoned on a space colony, but pre-crime continues.
Oh, okay.
So it's the opposite ending, actually, of the film where pre-crime is prevented by Anderton. It's stopped.
Also, the entire story is literally the same length as the extra ending in the film. 19 pages, probably about 20 minutes.
So this has an even more complicated backstory than I think even Total Recall, but I'm going to do it very briefly. David Hughes wrote a great book called Tales from Development Hell. Did you ever read that one, Alex?
I've got it. It's on my shelf.
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun, and there's a whole chapter on this one. But Gary Goldman, who we spoke about on Monday, in the early 1990s, he'd optioned Minority Report with a view to directing himself as a low budget feature, and he approached Paul Verhoeven to ask if he would executive produce, put his name behind it, even if he was not involved. Goldman said he read the short story, liked it, and agreed to help me out, then asked me if I'd thought about how well the story worked as a Total Recall sequel. Although it had nothing to do with the themes of the movie, there was something about the tone and driving narrative that made it seem perfect for a sequel. Verhoeven said there was an introduction in Total Recall that the mutants were perhaps clairvoyant, and that was used in the idea for the second one, where Quaid becomes the head of this company that can look into the future and protect citizens by eliminating criminals before they do the crime. Thus, the mutants would become the precogs of Dick's story. And so there was lots of wrangling with this script and whether it would be a standalone movie or a Total Recall sequel. And Goldman realised he could either direct the small movie or produce the sequel. And Goldman and Verhoeven then discovered that Ron Shusett, who we spoke about the other day, had a right to had a contractual right to write the first draft of any Total Recall sequel. It all starts getting quite messy, but they all agree they're going to push ahead. Arnold's going to star in it. Verhoeven's going to direct it now. And then Carol Coe went bankrupt. Screwed. And then it came into the hands of Jan de Bont.
Wasn't he a little bit naughty, Jan de Bont, in this story, though? Didn't he sort of sneak around trying to get this script from under Paul Verhoeven's nose? Like, because he was Verhoeven's former DOP.
Yep. So here's a quote from Paul Verhoeven. Somebody whose name I won't name without warning took it away. Somebody who has me on their pay list like a Judas. So they fell out.
Yeah.
So Fox have it as a non-sequel, a freestanding movie with Jan de Bont's going to direct it. And then novelist John Cohen is hired to adapt the story, write a new script. And Jan de Bont has a couple of flops. So he's out. Cruise reads Cohen's...
Big flops, though. What was it? The Haunting and Speed 2 Cruise Control. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Cruise reads the script, likes it, passes it on to Spielberg, who felt it needed some work. And Cruise and Spielberg had wanted to work together for 15 years. And the closest they came was Rain Man.
Yeah.
So Spielberg was directing Rain Man and then jumped ship to do Indiana Jones 3. And he often talks about that's his biggest regret because he was so... He doesn't say this bit, but he was so desperate for the Best Picture Oscar and Director Oscar.
Mm.
And that would have been his moment. But he, I'm happy he did Indy 3.
Yeah, I mean...
I think Indy 3 is more beloved and better remembered than Rain Man now.
Yeah.
Well, we can talk about that in the next 2 weeks almost.
Oh, we're doing Rain Man. So there was some time free, and then Frank came on board. And this is when it gets a bit juicy, because Scott Frank, he did a recent interview with a podcast called The Projection Booth, and he is pretty honest about how this went down. So he agreed to do a couple of weeks' work on this. His history with Spielberg was Scott Frank wrote a movie called Malice, which Spielberg liked and nearly directed. And at that same time, he asked Scott Frank to write Jurassic Park, and Scott Frank read the book and said, no, it's shit. And the kids are awful and I'm not going anywhere near it. So he turned it down because he wanted to focus on Malice. And then a few weeks later, he got fired from Malice.
Oh, by Spielberg?
No, Spielberg was off it by that point. Right. And Spielberg obviously really liked him because he then sent him Minority Report, which was this John Cohen script was a straightforward action movie. It didn't have as much of the sci-fi in it. And he said, do a couple of weeks, do a rewrite. Do what you can. And then Mission Impossible 2 got pushed back for Cruise. So Spielberg suggested they started over together, which was then a year-long project. And so Scott Frank had to leave. He was doing Charlie and the Chocolate Factory for Gary Ross. He walked away from that. But he really didn't want to do this. And so Spielberg said to him, I hate mysteries. I don't want to do mysteries. I've got no interest in making them. But do what you think is right with this. And so Frank wrote 30 pages of a mystery. He said, I didn't want to do this. He said, I wrote a dead child. I wrote a drug-addicted hero. I stuck two mysteries in there. I named the precogs after mystery writers. And I thought that would be it. And Spielberg loved all of it. So that was it. He had the gig. He decided, he sort of pitched it as the French Connection in the future. Mm-hmm. That was the tone he wanted to go for. He inserted the Burgess character, played by Max von Sydow, the bad guy. And he also rewrote Whitworth because Whitworth had become a villain, having been a hero in the short story. All the previous scripts had Whitworth as the villain, and then he became the hero in this version. And so, yeah, that was it, really.
He's doing really well, Scott Frank. He's a big deal. He just, wrote and directed and produced The Queen's Gambit.
Yeah.
You know, Queen's Gambit on Netflix. Yeah, so... Yeah. Doing well.
Yeah, I like him. And I like, he sounds like he's a very honest chap.
That's great.
Because I've got some stuff, he's got some thoughts about this, how this film turned out as well, which are he's not entirely happy with what Spielberg did.
And full respect to the production booth, because that is where I listened to the Gary Goldman interview Monday's pod. Yeah.
Good jobs. So in 1999, before they properly got going, Spielberg pulled together a 3-day think tank for this film to create a plausible future reality for the year 2054.
Oh, I wish I'd been in that room. That to me is just like a dream. Like, just assemble people who think they can see into the future and just let them do their work.
So, full disclosure and transparency for anyone who doesn't know, Vicky's obsession with future tech borders on the worrying.
He got an architect, a writer, an urbanist, a journalist, a computer scientist, a biomedical researcher, and they created a 2054 Bible, which was 80 pages for pre-production to create all the aspects of the world, architectural, socioeconomic, political, technological. And Scott Frank says...
should we just talk about that?
Well, Scott Frank says the best thing he got from that think tank was that they believed in the future the most precious commodity would be privacy.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting because that's 1999 before Facebook had even been invented, I think. And, you know, it's come true. It is probably one of the biggest crises facing us is the lack of privacy.
We realise it. I don't think if we said, what is your biggest worry for the next few years, we would even recognise that that's a thing. Mm. But that's the miracle of what we've given up without, you know, questioning it too much.
Yeah, it's disturbing.
Yeah.
So Spielberg went from not wanting to make a mystery movie to watching film noirs like Asphalt Jungle, Key Largo and The Maltese Falcon to prepare for this, although he said the mystery is less a whodunit and more a who's going to do it.
This is also very much like Poirot, I would counter at this point, but we'll get there.
Poirot? I wasn't expecting Poirot shot.
Like, yeah, you know, Poirot always gets everyone in a room. He's like, this is what happened. So in the last 5 minutes, Tom Cruise is Poirot.
That's all I've got. I mean, I've really powered through that. Anything else?
No, it's great for me.
Let's talk about the movie then with my first section called Nearly Everybody Runs. So we're at the Department of Pre-Crime in Washington, D.C., 2054. And I felt like I was immediately struck by the visuals here. Spielberg said he wanted ugly, cold, grainy, gritty, dirty.
Doesn't look like that.
Are you kidding? My picture looked grainy. I do properly, but that's what he intended it to.
Yeah, he used this bleach bypass process that removes the colours.
Yes.
And so it's a very strange experience watching this world where everything is sort of grey.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I genuinely have a problem with how this picture looks. And I know it was intentional, but the way that the light in every shot is overexposed, so the light coming through windows is just, it's all bleached out.
Yeah.
And the picture quality goes down as a result of whatever process they're using on this. And the reason, it's quite simple for me, is that it makes the future hyper real. And I think what's exciting about watching a sci-fi is seeing a very believable reality. So like in terms of like the picture quality, you want to go, well, this looks like tomorrow. It's just there's a hell of a lot going on here that isn't in today's technology. The minute you make it like these crazy hyper visuals is the minute you sort of then move it further away from reality, which kind of ruins why you watch sci-fi.
Mm. I feel like he's trying to make this is his film noir, but he can't go black and white. And so this is the closest he'll go to black and white. But I do think as well, it's been very influential. Like I feel like we've seen that washed out visual style used all over the place. It's on the telly a lot now. Like crime procedurals seem to use that a lot. CSI seems to use that.
Yeah.
But anyway, we meet the precogs in their pool and we see the images they produce, these precogs that can see into the future. And when we see what they see, Spielberg hired the company who made the opening credits for Seven. So they're the one. I gotta love Spielberg. That's brilliant. I'm using
I'll
steal that.
Yeah, they're good. I like the setup for the precogs. These three like sidekicks in the pool, Samantha Morton and the other two. So
the twins. And we watched John Anderson, played by Tom Cruise, investigating with his hands, trying to make sense of the visuals by sort of pushing screens around in the air.
By being basically a very good estate agent. Because he's like Regency Features or whatever. He's like, two spacious reception rooms. That's Barnaby Woods.
It's amazing how they combine like genuinely really like futuristic tech. Like, you know, we mentioned the gloves on Monday's episode, but the fact that he's conducting and doing all this and it's like, wow, that's kind of how people edit nowadays. And, you know, that's how they use
things. Yeah, but they couldn't invent Wi-Fi. I know I say this a lot.
It's like, can you get that over here? It's like, yeah, this massive Perspex rectangle. There you go. There it is. Good. That only took 20 minutes.
It's a big wow factor, though, I remember watching that for the first time.
Definitely.
Again, some of this stuff becomes a bit de rigueur, especially as Tony Stark obviously watched this film and decided he liked that tech.
But the thing is, I mean, like, we've talked about this on the show before. to have someone watching a computer, using a computer in any way, shape, or form, look cool and exciting and visually arresting and, like, you know, dramatic is difficult in a movie.
As the net proved on our very first episode.
But also to make it make sense, because he zooms in, so he uses it like we do to make the screen bigger with our fingers. This is in 2002, so it's mad to me that they got that right. But if you watch what John Anderton is doing, it kind of makes sense. So the freeze frame, drag and drop, and full zoom. Whereas in other films, like thinking of Jurassic Park even, you know the hacking into the mainframe thing, which I talk about constantly. What Lexi's doing, that computer system, makes fucking no sense whatsoever. And they're trying to have you, like, surf over these files that are not in alphabetical order and all the rest of it to make a nice visual. But at least in this, it kind of looks like a functioning operating system.
And it's not just fast cuts and stuff. It is about the operating system, because you just have to look at Swordfish, the Hugh Jackman hacking scene in Swordfish, which is all fast cuts and him sort of spinning on his chair stuff. And you're like, oh, this is... And I love you, Hugh Jackman, but this is not a good moment.
I would very much like to do Swordfish one.
Oh, love the start of that movie. Hate the rest. We've done it.
We watch the crime's about to be committed. And as we say, they get lots right. But in this crime, in the future, we're still getting newspapers delivered. I don't think that's happening in 2054.
It's weird, isn't it? Because that's the one thing I picked up on. Because they sort of, again, like the Perspex rectangle in the police station. It's the bit where they've got it right, that they've got newspapers on the tube that constantly update the news for you. So you're constantly getting a refeed, like the latest news feed. But you're still holding a newspaper, a digital newspaper that's big. Do you buy them every day? What is that?
Yeah. Our heroes take off in a flying hovercraft, which becomes a human Pez dispenser, which I quite like.
Yeah, that's good. But what they've literally, it's Slave One. It's Boba Fett's ship from Empire. It's crazy that they've gone, I'll have that design. Seven, like that. Empire Strikes Back, like that.
Cruise runs. He catches the murderer-to-be with 1 second to spare. And as I said, he's Howard Marks is the guy, not that one. And he doesn't run. So disappointing.
I feel so sorry for him. He's such a... He's so well cast.
Very well. He's a good actor, that guy. Oh, gross, yeah.
Great actor, but he also... He sets it up that, like, this idea of, like, you know, villain and yet sympathetic towards the villain because, you know, his wife's cheating on him and, like, you know, you're not sure if he's actually going to do it.
He's sort of sitting there crying, isn't he, holding the scissors.
Because pre-crime, that's the whole thing. He kind of embodies this whole question throughout the movie in one moment of whether the person is ever actually going to do it.
Well, he might not have done it, turns out.
Yeah, I buy it for this film, but just so-called crimes of passion, in quote marks, tend to be at the end of a pattern of very abusive behaviour. There isn't really any such thing as I've never done anything bad to my wife before and I just murdered her. Uh-huh. It doesn't matter what she was. It really doesn't fucking matter what she was doing. But in the real world, it's very unusual for someone to murder someone without having beaten them up before.
And you're reading from the production notes of Minority Report right now.
I'm just saying, I'll buy it for this. It's fine because, you know, but it's more interesting to me that he nearly doesn't do it. Not that what she's up to kind of thing.
Well, yeah, we don't know if he was going to do it.
No, I know.
So he gets haloed, which is the future equivalent of handcuffs. They put a halo on him, which immobilises him and gives him total paralysis. Into the next section, which I'm calling pre-crime stoppers.
That's great.
We get our exposition advert now. We learn that homicides were getting out of hand and society was given three miracles, the precognitives. And within 1 month, the murder rate reduced 90%, effectively stopped murder. They were called Agatha, Arthur, and Dashiell, after Christie, Conan Doyle and Hammett. Mm. And we also learn that there's a vote on a pre-crime initiative coming up. We spent some time with John Anderton as well, and he is messed up.
It was a bit uncomfortable. I'd forgotten about him being a drug addict.
Mm.
It is a bit weird to see Tom Cruise doing that. Like,
he's out getting drugs in the sprawl. He's taken a drug called Clarity, which I take for my allergies. He's watching a hologram of his ex-wife and his dead kid.
I hated that. You know, I sent you that thing of the classic dead. You meant to think she's dead as well as the kid. So the classic dead wife, ex-girlfriend montage where every single woman is like, oh my God, stop filming me. I'm disgusting. And it's like, you're obviously beautiful. But in real life, have you ever filmed your girlfriend and she's like, stop it? Like, rather than, what are you doing?
Yeah.
No.
I haven't filmed Alex's girlfriend.
I don't know who gets wasted and puts on videos of like their dead kid though. That is not what I do. Avengers Infinity War and Endgame back to back.
Why are you crying? Have you seen what just happened? The fucking Avengers are here.
Tony Stark is dead. He's dead. He's not coming back. He's probably coming back.
This scene was sicker in Scott Frank's script. He was manipulating the footage to have conversations with his son.
It kind of almost plays like that.
Yeah. He said it went a lot further, but he believes that this film quite a few places pulled its punches to get a PG rating, which he's quite annoyed about. But back to the office, the Justice Department wants to take it all away, and they send down Danny Whitwer as an observer, played by Colin Farrell, who is doing Tom Cruise in 1986, I think.
He's very good, though.
That is the performance.
Yeah.
Colin Farrell is freaking great. Like, and he's only got better, but here he's so good in this role. So good. He's so awful.
He's chewing gum. And he is kissing the religious icon around his neck. I think that's one too many bits of business. I think you chew the gum or you kiss the icon over and over again, but you don't do both.
Yeah, I mean, there's a moment later on when they're in the car factory where you go, yeah, I'm actually starting to question whether I think your performance is as good as it is, because I'm starting to think maybe it's just made up of a series of tics, which on first watch make you go, so fucking good. There's so much complexity about this character. But there's a bit where Tom Cruise escapes in the car and he punches the palm of his hand.
He does. He goes, oh!
No one ever does in real life. You don't go, oh!
One person does do that, and it's Robin from the 1960s Batman show. That is his maneuver. Well, Colin Farrell, I'm glad you like his performance in this. I do as well, but it's in this period where he had a lot going on, basically. He was drinking and drugging and partying. I think it came to a head on Miami Vice. I think that's the film he says he can't really remember making. But on this film, he does say that he spoke to the Daily Mirror, of all papers, about shooting this film. And he said, there were a couple of hairy days. I asked them with a great array of arrogance that they not work me the day after my birthday. I said, please don't have me work on June 1st because my birthday is May 31st. I thought a $100 million film would at least listen to that request. But I worked. It was a rough night and I didn't get any sleep. The line was, I'm sure you've all grasped the fundamental paradoxical pre-crime methodology. I only know it now still, 16 years later, because it caused so much panic and anxiety. It should be on my tombstone. My sister was on the set that day and she had to leave the set after 56 takes.
Oh! Wow.
So, yeah, and it's interesting. When he talks about this period, he says he sort of gets freaked out when he thinks about what he would be like in these films if he hadn't been...
like, disappointed.
No. Like, he doesn't know if he would have been better or worse. He said, if I hadn't been drinking and drugging, I hate to think, would I have been a better actor or worse actor at that time? He said it just freaks him out.
Yeah, that must be hard.
But he did a fine job.
I think sometimes it's that thing where because you work that little bit harder to be good to overcome how you're feeling, you put in the extra effort that you might not do otherwise.
Mm. Or you just might be off your tits. Then we get this. I found this a bit painful on this viewing. This conversation about where he starts asking tough questions about false positives and why they can only see murders that aren't. There aren't satisfactory answered, I don't think. And he heads down to see the precogs, and it gets quite religious, the conversation. Well, for a start, John Anderson, our hero, says something quite villainous. He says it's better you don't think of them as human, which I was quite shocked by that line. But they sort of talk about deifying the precogs, and it talks about science stolen most of our miracles. And it's just, they talk about destiny and... I feel like it all gets a bit heavy-handed and they're not actually talking to each other. They're trying to express the film's themes. Mm. I just didn't buy it as a conversation.
Yeah, it's a weird conversation. It's quite depressing when you think about the precogs as well in that conversation. Is that the conversation where they talk about how they aren't really aware of what's going on in the room and that they're so full of dopamine endorphins and have their serotonin levels fixed to be in a state of, I guess, happiness? I was on the line. I was like, is that actually a really good job? Just lying on your back in some warm water off your tits on dopamine.
Well, I mean, we don't know what they're aware of until a few seconds later when Agatha grabs John and shows her what we later learn is her mother's murder and says, can you see? And I feel like watching it, whatever, this is the fourth time I think I've seen it. Watching this time, I was trying to think about it from another point of view. And if you look at this film as Agatha's story, this is the moment the femme fatale starts orchestrating her own escape from prison. Which is an interesting thing. So it now turns into a proper neo-noir, which they fill with sort of colourful characters, as all great mysteries should. So immediately John goes to see Gideon the Century, played by Tim Blake Nelson.
Oh, he's so good.
Oh my God, I found him so annoying.
Yeah. Really?
Isn't that weird? Yeah, I like him, but it's just this... It was too, what's the right word? Like on purpose, kind of, I don't know.
Affected.
Yeah.
It's broad. It's very broad. And it's almost like he's come from a comedy.
Yeah.
Do you know what it feels like? It feels like he's in Danny Cannon's Judge Dredd. Is what it feels like. It feels like the kind of person who'd run the high security prison in a movie like that, a real comic book movie. That said, I think sometimes you just like, I think this happens throughout this movie where Spielberg has clearly just got actors to, you know, have a little bit of fun with these scenes. It happens with Peter Stormare later on as well.
Agreed. And I don't know if he said it or Scott Frank said it, or it's just the truth is like a mystery. You do go and meet five or six colourful characters as you, all of them do.
But it undercuts the prison is really fun, trippy, dreamy thing that you could like lose yourself in. And then Tim Blake Nelson, the way he plays it, just undercuts all of that because it, like you say, it just seems like a silly comic book thing. And there are moments throughout this film, they start pretty soon, like really ramping up, where there are these comic touches that feel out of place and it like makes the tone a bit bumpy. So like later on when Tom Cruise is running through the apartment block and a jet of fire flame grills some burgers that a family are cooking.
Oh, yeah.
Fucking hated that.
Yeah, that's sort of ridiculous.
That's ridiculous.
I feel like that's very Spielberg, though. With his action sequences, he always wants to put in a bit of sort of broad slapstick comedy.
And if that happened in Indiana Jones, you'd be like, sold, very funny. But in this, I do get what V said, because it's at odds with the sort of like this sort of noir tone. But the reason that I don't mind Tim Blake Nelson's performance is because it's... I think it adds something to the idea that like there is one man who's in charge of this prison and he sort of basically lives there and it's sort of off the grid almost and it's a fairly depressing job and he cooks his own fried breakfast on a little stove, not even a future stove, a little gas stove. So there's something about that that it works for me.
Fair enough. So John takes the information he has about Anne Lively, the woman who looks like she might have been murdered, to his boss, director Lamar Burgess. But more on him in a minute, because we're going to take a quick break now. And when we come back, somebody actually runs.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And we're back with the section I'm calling John Atherton Runs.
Atherton.
That's his name, isn't it?
Anderton.
Anderton. John Anderton Runs. I've written Atherton. Shit. because now we've got the twist. We've got the inciting incident because we've got a premeditated murder about to happen. The victim is Leo Crow. And John, using his screen, sees himself pulling the trigger. So he runs. He gets out of there. And I mentioned Lamar Burgess before the break, played by Max von Sydow. John now speaks to Lamar Burgess again. It feels like John Anderton doesn't take a piss without telling Lamar Burgess first, which is partly a problem for this film. And also, by this time in the movie, on my first watch, I'd figured out he was the villain.
Yeah.
It felt like Max von Sydow was playing the villain.
Yes.
In a weird way. You know, that thing he does, let's meet.
And yeah, come over. I want you to come over.
This is one of the bits I didn't like about the movie, where I just felt like he was in plain sight too much for me.
Yeah.
And now we get three action sequences in a row, starting off with some cars driving vertically, and Tom Cruise jumps from car to car. Alex, you're our action man. Did you like this?
Meh. I don't really understand why I don't. I guess it probably boils down to the fact that it's all CGI, and so there's literally nothing to grip onto that makes it feel real. You're watching magnetic cars on a vertical road that you don't recognise as anything like that features any of the physics of reality. So you're like, well, what is this? There's no tension. Like, you know, it's weird that in an action sequence like that, you go, I guess the best thing is the weird yoga upside down woman at the end. That's like the most fun part of it.
If that's the best bit, then we've got a problem.
But I'll go with Vicky. Like, I mean, what do you think of this bit first?
Yeah, I agree with you. It looks like a cartoon.
Mm.
But then we get onto an even worse bit, which is jetpacks.
Yeah, well, before then, we've got a scene where we see advertisers targeting people using their retinal scanners. Stuff that's happening now. This is all coming true. Mm-hmm. We're told that retinal scanner is to protect us, but also to track us. So like what Bill Gates is doing with his vaccine at the moment. Mm-hmm. And
might need to clarify that you don't mean that. You don't mean that, do you?
We'll say no for the purposes of our lawyers.
just want to say I have nothing to do with this podcast.
We have lawyers.
We're on the train when we get Cameron Crowe cameos. Did you not see?
No. The guy reading the paper,
staring at him, looking at his paper. That's Cameron Crowe.
Because they're really good friends, aren't they?
They just made Vanilla Sky.
Right, that makes sense. Yeah.
So that's a good, solid cameo. But as Alex says, we then get the jetpack scene.
Stupid.
How can you get this far in your career? And like Steven Spielberg needs to go, that looks stupid. Let's lose the jetpacks. Yes. I mean, his gauge on some of the things, the fact that the guys enter that spaceship hovercraft thing like the Thunderbirds in the first place is like, are you kidding? Yeah. They go into it like the fucking Thunderbirds. Yeah. And then when they're landing in the street, I mean, I don't know, you must have gone, Hawkmen. I was like, they look like fucking Hawkmen. This is Flash Gordon level of people landing.
The trouble is because the way the jetpacks are weighted, their center of gravity is like, so it's like their bum is slightly up in the air rather than they should just be purely vertical and be cool like whoosh. But they've got their bums up, which always makes you look a bit silly.
Steven Spielberg said he was inspired to do that by
Flash Gordon.
Worth.
Go on.
Seeing a bloke land at the 1984 LA Olympics in a jetpack.
In 1984.
He saw that and thought, I'm going to do that in a film.
Jetpacks, I can't think of a movie where jetpacks work. I'd be interested to know if anyone can. I just, that to me, they are always something you go, cool, it's a jetpack. Wait, that's not cool.
Iron Man.
Not a jetpack, though. It's a whole suit. It's not a jetpack. Because of the things in his hands. That's how he directs himself so nimbly. Like, a jetpack is just on the back. Anyway.
Iron Man and Rocketeer. We done them. You weren't there that week.
Oh, yeah.
We get a glimpse at the Six Sticks. Anyone fan of the Six Sticks?
That's a great idea.
Great. That's good. That's fun tech.
Yeah. Because all the weaponry in the future, the idea is non-lethal because no one can be killed. Murdered, rather. So we end up in a factory. This is another scene that Scott Frank isn't totally happy with, but
because
he says
it's stupid.
Yeah, and also because it's three action scenes in a row, which he said is just
but
not
also,
something he would write.
He gets sealed inside the car. And then he's like, oh, look, this car drives and it's fine. It's the future. So it's powered on electricity, presumably, or whatever. Who opens the fucking doors to let him out? So he powers off and Colin Rowe's like, curses, and like smashes his palm.
What conveyor belt of cars ends with the cars just rolling
just
off, finished,
off. Yeah.
And straight out the door that you're off to meet your owner. Right, that's it. Off you go.
So Alfred Hitchcock wanted to do a car factory sequence where the characters are walking along and a car's being assembled in the background. And when they get to the end of the assembly line, the car is finished and a body falls out of it. And that's what inspired Spielberg to put this in this movie. Before he's in the car, though, we've got the fight on the moving platform. Again, I'm not sure about Whitwer kissing his cross before he goes to punch. It feels just too much business going on.
Yeah. Oh,
he spits the blood, and then a minute later, he's kissing the cross.
Forgive
and it's
me,
like,
Jesus.
Just get on with your
I thought
fight.
He was kissing it because he'd sort of made a leap of faith to get onto the platform in the first place and could have fallen off and hurt himself. And so it was a thank you for keeping me safe this far.
Maybe so. I just, as I say, too much business. But Anderton then heads to Dr. Iris Heinemann's greenhouse.
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah.
What on earth is this? So
no, I like it because it's weird.
It's very weird.
We've got poisonous sentient vines that attack you when you climb over a wall. This is like,
what's wrong with the scene is that she just tells him everything. Just everything.
Yes, he briefly gets poisoned while she does this lengthy exposition dump explaining that the precogs are kids of drug addicts who were being tested on. Which is that, I meant to check this, is that the plot of Stranger Things? I feel like that's where 11 comes from as well.
She was tested on to make her like that.
And the parents were given drugs as well, weren't they?
You're right.
But it's strange, isn't it? And then she kisses him. I find that a strange moment.
That to me is like, talking about like sort of shoehorning in these moments that don't quite work. So the burgers, then later when he loses his eye and it falls down that drain, stupid. But this, you don't often see an older woman do that. And if you're honest with yourself, when you watch the scene, you're like, there is sexual tension in here, but I must be misreading it because I've brought all my like judgment to this scene and to an actor of that age and there's no way she's going to do it. When she does, it's like, good for you. But it's a weird, like, I don't mean weird as in like a judgy way, but just a sort of off-center touch, which elevates the scene. I think because she's such a good actor and he's good in it as well, you get away with this huge exposition
and
dump.
Really, by doing that kiss, I just thought about this, she really straddles generations because at the start of her career, she kissed James Dean on screen.
Oh, okay.
In East of Eden. So Lois Smith is the actress. She's 91 now, and she has three films in the can, including the new Wes Anderson movie.
Really?
Wow. So she's still going strong.
Yeah, I'll be completely honest with you, switched off in that scene. It was just too much information. There is a finite amount of exposition that you can take in and manage to retain.
Yeah. But I know why you switched off, Alex. It's because he's got to find the Minority Report. We find about now. They use the title in the scene here. And she says, it's always in the more gifted of the three. And Anton says, which one is it? And she says, the female.
Yeah.
So
why doesn't she say, obviously? Like, it really bothers me. It's like, I thought after everything that had happened and the kiss as well and her, like, there was something that just lends itself to her going, the female, of course.
Yeah.
It feels like just saying the female... they're missing a trick.
I would just say when it's three people in a room and two are men and one's a woman, the woman isn't always the more gifted. I'm just going to put that out there.
Oh shit, we'd be the fucking twins.
Yes! That's why I used that. Get in at mate.
Oh, I hate this show.
The useless twins.
Oh, I hate this episode. I hate this episode.
The one-eyed man is king. We're into this section. So he's worried he'll
but...
be identified.
But...
what?
Vicky does have to be held up and helped to walk a lot more than either of us. So it does really fit. Agatha spends a lot of the time with her arms straight around Tom Cruise going, can you get me out of it?
Anderton visits Dr. Solomon Eddy, played by our old friend Peter Stormare, a.k.a. Blonde from Fargo. And he clockwork oranges his eyes.
Do you know that he did? He must have done that.
Yeah. I'm sure he did.
It's so realistic.
But our villain is also called Burgess, Anthony Burgess. Yeah. I feel like he's doing a clockwork orange thing in this movie.
Did you not feel a bit disappointed? This scene, I think, is brilliant and suitably like off kilter again. But it all builds to nothing because the doctor is like, I'm going to take my revenge on you. Yeah. And yes, I burned my patients and now you're drugged and now you're really fucked because I'm going to take your eyes. Oh, no, look, I just did a brilliant job.
Yes. I guess they're trying to do the unexpected by trying to think as the story's going one way and then going the other. But
yeah,
it's an anticlimax.
But I know that is really interesting. Why do it? Because on the one hand, you are going, this is different. Mm. But then for it to not mean anything, that's not how film works.
Yeah.
Just throwing in that information.
You think he's going to set fire to him or kill him or this woman's going to sexually assault him.
Yeah.
And then
or at least do something with the eye that pays off later. Yeah. So you think the operation's gone well. And just when he needs those eyes to see, they fuck him.
They just leave him with some mouldy sandwiches.
They don't leave him with the mouldy sandwich. He makes him a fresh sandwich and Tom Cruise, John Enderton picks up the wrong sandwich and then drinks the wrong milk.
What?
Yeah. So spider-bots show up.
That's quite good.
That's fine. I'm not as scared as if they'd been snake-bots. Snake-bots would have done me in, but spider-bots, I'm fine.
They do look quite cute, don't they?
Shark-bots, that would scare me. Swimming into the bath where he is.
He uses a wand to mishmash his face up, basically to give him the deformed face he had in Vanilla Sky.
Yeah.
Very strange that this is like a couple of years after and he's just got his Vanilla Sky face back.
It's quite weird, that whole doctor scene, because the film has had this real momentum and it manages to keep it going despite the fact that he, at that point, it's like 12 hours are going to pass, 6 hours pass in the end. But it's a real sort of like a comma in the whole thing, because he's been running and running and running. And it's like, so stuff is happening and we sort of spend it all in the room with him and 6 hours have passed.
Yeah.
I find that quite strange.
He goes and grabs Agatha and they get flushed down the toilet / reborn.
That's good.
I
couldn't remember that bit. And the fact that he's like, they go, we've got all the exits covered. And you're like, oh, I wonder how he's, hey, plug hole.
He retrieves what's in her head and we start realising Anne Lively is her mother. And I didn't realise that's Jessica Harper who plays Anne Lively. She's the woman in Suspiria.
Oh.
Yeah, she's a horror legend. They're in a mall and Agatha can see into the future, so guides him out of the mall, much like Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure when they're escaping
from
the prison. But watching all the extras on this DVD, Cruise and lots of people talk about how spontaneous Spielberg is on set, and I'm thinking, is he really? I don't know. Are you just saying that? But Scott Frank is interesting. He literally called Scott Frank down to set and said, we've got an opportunity here to do some kind of exciting chase scene, come up with something. And so Scott Frank had the mall location and wrote that entire sequence with the umbrella and the escape on set, on location, and they filmed it.
I think it's really effective. I think it's the sort of thing that maybe he was trying to do with the other sort of slapstick stuff, where it's a fun sequence, the promise of the premise, she can see into the future, what is it and how is it going to act out? And it's not that... There is a threat there, but it's mostly just silly fun, like the brolly, take the umbrella, that. And then the
stand
way that
behind
pays
the balloons
up,
and
it's great.
It's very effective. They make it to a hotel. Alex, who's the clerk at the hotel behind the desk?
Dude from Swordfish.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
What else has he been in?
It's William Mapotha.
Yeah, he's in Swordfish. I thought that's why you're bringing it up, because we were doing a Swordfish loving.
No, he's got a connection. What's Tom Cruise's last name?
Oh.
It's Tom Cruise's cousin. He was in quite a few Tom Cruise movies. I only know him from Lost.
I didn't know he was his cousin.
Yeah, sorry, I'm probably saying his name wrong. Mapotha, probably.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's in quite a few of his films just popping up.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he kept the name, but Cruise went with Cruise.
He had quite his middle name. I think one of his biggest roles was Swordfish. He was in a few things. He did a lot of henchmen for a while.
Yeah.
He's good.
So we're into the hotel room, room 1006.
Ugh, the whole 6-9 thing.
Which is what I'm saying. It's like, it is an Agatha Christie story, or it is Poirot, because that is your classic Sunday night telly. Ooh. This thing has fallen down off the door.
But it doesn't have any relevance to anything. It's not like he goes into one room and then something happens that then
which
leads
him. Which then propels him.
Yeah.
But before he enters, he says to Agatha, I'm not going to kill the man. I don't even know him. And we as the audience have already figured out that this is going to be involving his son. How has he not figured this out?
Yeah.
Who's the only person in the world I would definitely kill that I'm obsessed with? But it's quite an effective scene here. He finds the pictures of his son on the bed amongst the pictures of other children, finds pictures of his son with this guy, and then he's changed his mind. He says, I'm going to kill this man, and she says, you still have a choice. And then Leo Crow walks in and they have a fight and she's screaming and he says, I've killed your kid, and he pulls his gun. And it's kind of the John Doe in Seven plan at the end, isn't it, to force someone to commit a murder.
We already know he likes Seven, so that makes sense. I want to know whether they left Leo Crow to come up with the explanation for what he did to his son, or whether Max von Sydow, Lamar, actually prepped him and gave him a little script, because it's fucking awful. The bit where he goes, I put him in a barrel and sunk him in the bay, and then he floated back up.
I think it's part of the whole thing. I think it's scripted for him, because water, like, I feel like there's an obsession with water all the way through this film. I don't know if our villain has it, but...
I think it's the button on it, which if it was written for him or not, but when he says, I was gentle, you'd be like, no, I'm definitely going to kill you, because what the fuck is this?
So
it's so dark. And I think it's quite brave for the script to say that sort of thing, because that is just the worst nightmare you've ever had.
But John's our hero here, because he doesn't go through with it. He does not shoot him. He decides not to do it, but Leo pulls the gun and shoots himself. Whitworth shows up a few moments later and he finds an orgy of evidence.
Yeah.
This was all arranged, he says. It's a very fast turn for Danny Whitworth, I think, in this moment.
Yeah.
Maybe it's showing that he's good at his job, but he's not that good at his job, because he heads straight to Lamar's place.
Tells him everything.
We learn about the fact that someone's been making murders look like an echo, or echoes look like a murder. And then we get the scene that very much upset me in the cinema.
What, when Colin Farrell dies?
Yes.
Because
it's the LA Confidential scene. Yeah. It's done so similarly to that, but not quite as well, because they telegraph the moment slightly more here, where if you haven't figured it out, they kind of tell you a few seconds before. But I just felt like I'd seen that scene exactly, but done much better. And it was only 5 years before.
Yeah.
Annoyed me.
It didn't annoy me, because I swear that I was watching this going, Colin Farrell doesn't die. He's around at the end of this movie. Seen it twice. This is the third time. I really can't remember that he dies in this movie. I always think he comes back at the end and switcheroos, and he's like, yeah, sorry about all that, John.
I mean, I think it would be effective if LA Confidential hadn't just come out, but it's just an annoying...
But I think the thing is, the reason it works in LA Confidential is because Jack Vincennes, the character at that point, is like, he is a good person, or he's back, he's doing good things in a much more obvious way, and he's trying to solve this. Like, Colin Farrell, Whitworth's character, he's not actually there yet. You need a little bit more of a breath before you then kill him, so we can become accustomed to actually, God, this guy might be the guy to save Tom Cruise's character. This might be his turnaround is going to impact this whole film. Is going to impact Tom Cruise's life. He's going to be there at the end.
We know that. He's pieced enough of it together that we know he's got to the bottom of it. That's why Lamar kills it.
But it's too soon. Yeah, that's why he kills
it. This was all arranged. They're making murders. Someone's making murders look like an echo.
I know.
That's the plot.
I'm just saying, for me, as a viewer, I just need a little more space between him working it out and him becoming this good guy before he gets off, for it to have more impact on me, because I'm still a bit like, guy's a bit of a tool.
Fair enough. Agatha and John go and meet up with John's ex-wife. What's her name? Laura. And
Laura.
Agatha describes the life or the sun.
I didn't get this.
I did get it, but only on this viewing.
Is it like a multiverse thing?
No, it's confusing. I agree it's confusing, but I think the ending reveals to you what she's describing. We think she's describing the life they would have had with their son, but it makes no sense because that never happened.
Yeah.
But the final shot of the movie, she's pregnant. I think what she's describing here is the son, the future they're going to have with her newborn baby. That kid's going to be a runner.
With their replacement
which
baby.
Is a really beautiful thing, but you don't realise it until the end, and it's probably not a big enough moment to go back and think
That's nice, yes.
Oh, I never worked that out.
No.
Because I was sort of going,
yeah,
it seems like a bit of a long-winded way to go, but it's really about me and I need you to save me.
And she spends a lot of time talking when the baddies are coming. And it's like, well, at what point does she know? Could she have stopped her speech a little earlier and gone, run? But when she screams out run, I do love the way Spielberg shoots that with the whip pans and the crash zooms and the sort of world coming in on John Anderton.
Yep.
And this is very late in the show. This is sort of his final low point, because he's now a prisoner in suspended animation. It's all over for him. Where, I think with a couple of scenes, they could have ended the movie, but they didn't because...
When you say they could have ended the movie, you want it to end on a bum note. Like, he fails, Max von Sydow wins, and he gets locked up. It's like Brazil.
Yeah, or he fails, but, you know, something that he does ends up winning the day. That, like, they figure out Lamar Burgess is the villain by something he's done. Like, as I say, a couple of scenes just to button it. But, like, I feel like what happens from here, it felt like the end of the movie. Like, I feel like the momentum comes out of the movie a bit now. It's exactly 2 hours in, and the rest of it feels like a postscript, except it lasts for 20 minutes.
But this is the argument, isn't it? This is what a lot of people say. This is a lot of people say that this is all because Tim Blake Nelson says... you dream the most wonderful dreams. You live your perfect life once you go into these tubes.
That life flashes before your eyes.
And so
all your dreams come true.
All your dreams come true. So after this point, he is just in there, and everything that happens after this point is him dreaming in whatever they call it, in status or whatever.
I think that's a fan theory that's incorrect, though.
Do you?
And I think if what Gideon said was true and all your dreams come true, why his son would still be dead and not returning. Mm. So what we get is Laura figures stuff out.
Lara.
Is it Lara?
Yes, it's Lara. Mm.
Okay, chill out.
Sorry. It's because you said Laura, you said Lana. It's like, between us, I think we should just get it right.
It's Lena.
I think she's bad in this, but...
She goes to visit Lamar, but she knows too much, he realises quite quickly. And then he gives himself away by saying the drowned...
Yeah.
The drowned
when
line.
When she walks
like...
in there, and she's like, oh, what about Anne Lively? He goes, oh, yeah, John mentioned something about drowning, but, you know, he was onto something, it was the wrong thing. And then you're done. That's fine. Like, she can't be... I never said she drowned. Oh, all right, Poirot.
It's just one of those... It's clunky for such a clever villain.
Yeah.
Who's thought of everything, and then to admit that he's drowned her. It is. It's an oops moment.
And also, I don't remember Lara being told that that she did drown. I don't remember that scene. I'm sure it happens where John tells her that she drowned, but I don't remember it. So it needed to be bigger so that you realise that she knows that you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So she goes to get John out of suspended animation.
Question. Yeah. Why would the eye of a convict get you into prison?
Well, why haven't they fucking wiped that from the police headquarters the minute they go, yeah, so he's a murderer now. We should probably wipe his retinal scan.
He's not allowed in here anymore.
He tries to come in through the back door, apparently, which the temple has, where he just come in through the back door and go out through a plug hole.
Wipe his retina scan. Yeah, I just think with something like this, if it's a low budget film and it's someone's first shot or whatever, you'd be fine. Like, don't worry about it. But these, you know, the highest paid stars and directors and probably writers in the world at that point or whatever, you just need to do a bit better than Lara putting down this packet of eyes, being like, that's how I fucking got in. Like, it doesn't make any sense.
At the same time, we've got a big celebration happening because pre-crime is going national. And Lamar Burgess's wife gives him not a gun, she gives him Chekhov's gun, which is the worst example of that I've ever seen in a film. We're going to give it to him 30 seconds before he has to use it.
Yeah, that's ridiculous as well. Who gives people... They give him a loaded fucking working gun. I thought the joke was going to be, I was like...
Exactly.
It's like he goes to use it and he's like, I'm going to kill you, John, and he shoots it and he's like, no firing pin, because it's a fucking prop gun.
We learn that Lamar Burgess killed Anne Lively. Lively, Agatha's mother. She drowns in a red coat.
Yeah.
Don't look now.
Yeah.
It just happens over and over again, doesn't it? Every film wants to go at it. And that echo, that vision gets projected at the reception, so everyone knows that Lamar's...
I like the fact that he can't run. Literally nobody runs. He knows what is going to be played on the screen. And he's like, I'll walk out the door and then I'll just stop and close a glass door and then watch just from the back of the room with everyone else because, you know, I like my handiwork.
I think Max von Sydow literally can't run probably at the time. So he starts talking about when John shows up, he starts talking about the greater good, thinking about all the lives that have been saved.
Bluetooth headsets. Nice.
Yes.
Pretty cool. And at this point, John Anderton is dressed as Ethan Hunt from Mission Impossible. Ghost Protocol.
Yeah.
And Anderton explains to him the dilemma that he's got. If he doesn't kill him, the precogs are wrong, pre-crime is over. And if he does, he goes away but proves precogs were right and the system works. He repeats that a couple of times, like we're stupid. Lamar makes his choice. He says, forgive me, John. Fires and kills himself. So the precogs were wrong. And we get the information in 2054. The 6-year pre-crime experiment was abandoned. All prisoners were unconditionally pardoned and released, though police departments kept watch over them for years to come. Bit wishy-washy. John and Laura are back together and she's pregnant. As I say, I think that is what Agatha's vision is concerning, their life together in the future. And Agatha and the twins are living in an undisclosed location to live out their lives in peace.
I mean, what is that place? How they don't seem like they should be left in a shack on an island on their own in the middle of nowhere. I mean, I just think, keep an eye on them. Forget about these criminals. Keep an eye on these people who've been sitting in a pool of fluid for 6 years.
It feels like a very happy ending.
Yeah. That's why it's a dream. John Anderton's all he's dreaming it all.
And it's not what Scott Frank wrote. So, and Frank reckons that Spielberg took his eye off the ball, and the studio head as well was very against what he had written. So what he wrote...
It's literally word for word what Shia LaBeouf said about Spielberg with Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. People shouldn't say that about Spielberg.
So what he wrote was that the precogs are not leading some idyllic existence, but rather in the only place in the world where they can't see murders, which is an island in the North Sea. They can't grow anything there. It's miserable. And Agatha is looking at the only image she has of her mother, which is her dying.
Wow.
We also learned that following pre-crimes abandonment, there were 137 homicides in DC the next year.
Right.
So that's how his version of the film ends. He said the studio head thought it was too dark, but Frank believes that they fumbled the film on the 1 yard line.
I do think, it doesn't look like the North Sea to me. I don't know about islands in the North Sea, but I always imagine it a bit bleaker than that. Maybe that's wrong.
What do you mean? Sorry?
The island at the end.
Yes, no, that's what he wrote for it to be.
Oh, so that's
this
not...
Is his ending is much grimmer than that idyllic
Why
existence.
The North Sea?
I don't know. I guess he just decided that was like the most remote place you could be.
Horrible place in the world. I mean, he's been to the Isle of Man, but it's fucking horrible.
Can you imagine?
I did think that was quite funny.
The only... Just imagine, all I keep seeing is murders on oil rigs just over and over again.
And that is it. So, are we done?
Yep.
Okay. Favorite scene, Mr. Zane.
You didn't actually mention it. I thought the most effective scene is the flashback to when his kid is kidnapped and he's in the swimming pool. I just think it's a really, I don't know what I do not have children, as we know. And yet both them. The bit in Us that we talked about the other week where she's like the bit that I think is missing in that is where she can't find her kid. And in this, it's where he can't find his kid. I just think it's really, really well done, really effective.
I mean, if that's your favourite scene, you're pretty fucked up.
It's my favourite scene.
Yay!
It's either that or the setting up of the tech, because that's the one I always remember. And I'm really in love with it.
Why do you love that scene then?
The Sean disappearing. Because it's the one place that looks like a now place, because the public pool isn't a futuristic particularly.
Well, it's the only scene where they use colour as well, where they stop using the washed out.
And the reason it's so effective is because he's playing a game with him. He's not cross with him. He's not just wandered off or anything like that. It would feel like very much his fault. He's just playing this little innocent game and he's gone super quickly. And the minute that watch drops into the water, like, you know that you're in big trouble.
It's a good Spielberg moment as well, the watch.
Watching the water. But I think Cruise is fantastic in that scene when he's sort of running around and like he starts asking, have you seen a kid in red trunks? And it's like you sort of get the panic, the growing panic, the chaos. It's just really good.
Yeah.
I'm going for the scene inside room 1006. I don't think this is a film that particularly rewards repeat viewings, actually. But I remember the tension and the suspense I felt and the confusion the first time I watched it. I just thought it played out really cleverly.
Mm.
Most valuable whatever, Vicky.
Samantha Morton as Agatha. Even though she does just get dragged around quite a lot. when she's in an episode of Cracker in the early 90s, and I remember watching that when I was really little, and I was like, she is astonishing.
She was brilliant.
So good in that, and you could tell that she was just going to go on and just be so intense, amazing. Have you seen Morven Keller? Like, she's
well, I was
awesome
going to say,
that.
She made that the same year she made this, which blows my mind. Every now and then I like to talk about on here an actor that has an incredible year.
Mm.
That is mad that she did. I only watched it for the first time recently. I mean, it's a tough watch.
Yeah.
But brilliant. And she is just phenomenal in it. And so, to do that and then the Spielberg movie in the same year.
But also, obviously a great director, but she brings all of herself to that. She's not like a sort of Hollywood version of... She is just that, intense. I thought she was brilliant.
Alex.
Mr. Tom Cruise. I think he's great. I think he's, I'm reminded every time I watch him that he's, especially now, because obviously this is back in 2002, but there aren't many movie stars left, actual marquee name movie stars. And, you know, I would have gone out and seen this, and I did, as a lot of people will have done, because his name was above the title. That and Spielberg together is kind of a big deal. And I think he really sells it. Like, I think he really works for me in this role of John Anderton. And, you know, I have issues with the film, but I think he is he's just like this beating heart in the middle of it. I really like him.
Agreed. I'm going to give Dick some love.
Mm-hmm. Out time.
He might not have written this story exactly.
Nice.
Because Scott Frank, I said that the short story when it was given to him, he thinks Philip K. Dick isn't a particularly good writer and that his characters are one-dimensional and the stories are quite flat and badly written. But his ideas...
He really doesn't pull any punches, does he?
But his ideas, he's an idea machine, isn't he, Philip K. Dick? And he inspired this story, he inspired Total Recall, so much great sci-fi, and a tragedy he wasn't around to witness it all, because he died just before Blade Runner came out. So Philip K. Dick. And if you could change anything, what would you change, Alex?
The visuals, I sort of went early on that one, but I really don't like the way this film looks. I don't like the washed out thing, but more than that, you know, because we do movies is a kind of important part of my life. I have a big TV now on which I like to look at a really nice picture. And in the film's defense, I didn't look very long. I just clicked because I was in a bit of a rush. I was like, click, click, I'll watch this version. And then I was like, are there better versions out there? Has this been remastered in a better way than what I'm watching right now? Because it was still HD, but it was just so freaking grainy and messy and blown out in the background. So I did not like the way the film looks.
Vicky.
Super quick, three things. Lara should be dead. It's annoying that she's alive, and we should pick up another female character that's a bit like Lara is so pure and she's this perfect grieving mother and she's very clean and all the rest of it, and they get back together with no sort of hiccups. So he should pick up a sort of, let's say, a demure but sleazy woman along the way that he
is
then.
Is she
sort of...
athletic?
I think she might be brunette as well. So that, hammer home, if the pre-crime division is closed, let's go to town on the themes here, which is even though there will be murders now, we have free will back again. So, because that's what's in this story. But the biggest thing is, at the end, the precogs are in their beautiful cottage and the screen should glitch so that you think they are actually in Rufus's like VR tank. And that's the only... And so what they're experiencing is real is not real. And then with that one glitch, sequel.
That's cool. That's good about the crime is back thing, because the one thing we didn't mention is the Miranda Wright scene where he sort of, when John Anderton is reading him the Miranda Rights for the first time, which I think, you know, they've stopped doing with pre-crime because you haven't actually done anything. I think it would be nice if he sort of stumbled over it in that scene, like he's forgotten it because it has been so long since he's had to read them.
My change is harsh, actually, because I love this actor and I think he's good in this film, but I would get rid of Max von Sydow.
Wow.
Because as soon as I saw him, I knew he was the villain. And I don't know. It might be because of James Cromwell in LA Confidential and them just being quite similar and interchangeable to me, the characters, the performances. And so, yeah, give me someone that's going to throw me off the scent a little more, because I love not knowing a twist until the end. And that one, it was just there in front of me. Sorry, Max. R.I.P.
Right then. Is that it?
Mm-hmm.
Done. Let's do the verdict.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth.
So, Victoria's choices. How do you want to run your verdict today, V?
I think I will go first.
What?
Shall I not do that?
Yeah. Do it.
Okay, great.
Mix it up. We've never had this before.
Only because when we pick these films, I was pretty sure I knew which way I was going to go because of my obsession with predicting technology. So the accuracy with which Minority Report predicted technology had, I think it had made it more indelible in my mind, but it turns out for the wrong reasons. The payoffs aren't great. The goofy stuff I don't like. I don't think that works. But it overall made for a really strong impression on me because of the tech. In Total Recall, the amount of shooting, that's the sort of thing that just, it's a personal bugbear. It just gets all this noise. I can't like follow. It's just relentless. And I think it saps tension out of things. But I think it handles the lighter stuff, like the silly running around, and the heavier stuff about identity in a much smoother way.
Mm-hmm.
And the cast, because they're not shaded on Arnie, but because they're orbiting around Arnold Schwarzenegger, they do a lot of work because they sort of have to, mm-hmm. particularly Sharon Stone. So I think that makes for a more coherent experience. So Total Recall.
A coherent experience.
Very good.
All right, who do you want to go next?
Well, see, now I wanted to go first because I thought I might be the one that might be less predictable. But yeah.
Do you think we're both predictable? I think we're both predictable here. Yeah. I 100% know what Alex is going for.
Yeah, all right. So, Alex, you go.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you want to go, Chris, or shall I go?
What did I just say? I just said you go.
All right. Fucking hell. It's Lara! Lara!
How can you literally just not listen to me in front of my face?
Sorry. I'll go first.
Oh, right then. After you, Chris. It's the gift that keeps on giving. As I said, Minority Report gets better every time I watch it because I guess...
Because you've watched it twice.
It's increased. It depends on my mood. Listen, I'm not going to dance around the truth here. Look, it's 100% Total Recall. Like, I don't think there's a conversation to have here. They simply do not make them like that anymore. And more's the pity. We don't use practical effects like that. We don't have directors capable of handling a blockbuster like Paul Verhoeven while still delivering R-rated thrills and jet black humor. And you do not have stars, even though the closest we have to that is Tom Cruise. You just don't have stars like Arnie was in 1990. It's not just nostalgia, genuinely. 1990, amazing. It is nostalgia. Wrap me up in a rose tinted duvet. Like, it's fantastic. It's Total Recall. Done.
Hey!
Yay!
Whoop, whoop. Wins.
What were you going to go for, Chris?
Well, contrasting forms of movie making, I think it's fair to say. One sort of grown up sci fi, the other is more extreme and aimed at 13 year old me. Both parallels, both strong social messages, both are very good, I think. So tough to pick a winner. Minority Report, I think intentionally so, leaves me cold, making it a film that's hard to love. Whereas Total Recall is a proper romp. It's fun from start to finish. It's balls to the wall. I bloody love it. Total Recall all the way. Yay! 3 for 3. Easy this week.
What about that?
Not that hard. I said it was hard. It wasn't that hard.
It wasn't that hard. So Total Recall, 3 for 3. A slam dunk, of course. So that is the end of this week's show. Thank you for listening. Coming up next, the week after next, we're going indie crazy as part of Steven Spielberg's season. Aren't we, Chris?
Yeah, respond to the tweet that I will have pinned, I think, about Indiana Jones on @ClashPod, and tell us what is your favourite Indiana Jones film and why, or any memories you've got of watching those movies. Equally, you can email us at show@clashpod.com.
That's lovely. Indiana Jones season coming up as part of Spielberg season. 2 seasons for the price of one. But before that, we have another Spielberg week. The clue I gave you was, oh, you get everything. You win. I can't remember. It was a very good clue. I mean, liked it a lot.
Was it just a direct quote from one of the films?
Yeah.
No, it was a reverse of the quote. So it worked for the other movie as well. Because the actual quote is you get nothing. Okay. You lose.
Oh, very clever.
Good day, sir. So I reversed it. You get everything. You win. Good day, sir. And you'll realise why right now. Because Victoria, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory from 1971.
Amazing.
Oh, lovely. Because you love musicals. So that's perfect.
Oh, amazing. I do love a musical. Consider yourself. Is that in it?
Home. No.
Oh, okay. That is free on Netflix and Amazon Prime. If you have an Amazon Prime account, Christopher, and you'll work out why the quote works now, the clue rather. 2018, Ready Player One.
Oh, lovely jubbly.
That's our Spielberg movie. You have to rent that, unfortunately. I think it's about £3.49 on Amazon and Google Play and YouTube, whatever your chosen provider might be. I couldn't check if they were on Sky because my Sky's on the blink.
You have to rent it from Sky.
Right, yep. Fair enough. So you have to rent it wherever you get it. That is us done for this week. Get your homework in. Ready Player One versus Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. If you haven't already subscribed to us, please do on Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your pods. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram @ClashPod. Back on Monday talking Willy Wonka. Bye-bye.
This was a Stakhanov production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Hi,
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.